I will always look for someone who shows a willingness to learn things and can communicate well and has a track record of getting things done.
Welcome to Scaling Software Teams, a weekly podcast to help software leaders navigate fast growth without losing the magic that made that growth possible. I'm your host, Wes Winham. Today, we're joined by Roger Dietz. Roger is the VP of Engineering at Springbuck, a fast-growing scale-up in our hometown of Indianapolis. Before that, he was the Vice President of Engineering at Angie's Home Services, where he led their software engineering modernization project. I got a lot out of this conversation with Roger, and especially enjoyed the discussion of the juxtaposition of development work and management work. The transition from what helps us feel productive as a software engineer compared to an engineering team leader is a transition that a lot of people struggle with. Roger's story illustrates ways you can help your new engineering managers overcome the psychological barriers to leadership. Now, without further ado, here is my conversation with Roger Dietz. So Roger, what is the most important inflection point in your career that got you to where you are today?
That's a interesting question because I can kind of rattle off like three or four inflection points that I can think of, but I'll go with one that I think was probably the most impactful. I guess it was going on 6 years ago when I had recently joined Angie's List. We went on the mission to rebuild the architecture to make it more scalable, to prepare Angie's List for future growth, to kind of modernize and reinvent the technology stack. And I don't think this is necessarily a great organizational pattern, but the way it was sort of set up was there was me and a very small band of folks that were chartered with doing that. So it was a fantastic technical opportunity and a fantastic professional leadership opportunity. And, you know, really being able to jump into something like that and have to not only chart a challenging technical course, but also to lead and execute a project when you didn't really have any official like team or budget or title. It was all leading by influence and not sort of by mandate was a very challenging thing to do. And so I think that the skills that I gained both technically and leadership wise as part of that project are lessons that really I've carried with me ever since. And I use it like almost daily. So again, I don't think necessarily that's a great way to actually execute a project, especially one at the scale that we were going for. But in terms of my own personal development, it was an enormous opportunity and it kind of put a bunch in my tools in the toolbox that I use almost every day.
What are some of those tools that helped you convince the folks that didn't have to listen to you, but convince them that it was in their best interest to listen to what y'all were doing?
Yeah, sure. Well, I mean, you have to sell people on the vision. You have to sell people on the value of what you're doing. You have to get them excited about something, even if they don't really know exactly what it is. And that's something that within, particularly within engineering organizations, you know, people are often very focused on, you know, solving specific problems. And so when you're getting people excited about a vague problem, sometimes that's a challenge. Especially when you have people that don't report to you in the org chart sense, you know, the only way that you can influence them is by kind of getting them to buy into something and want to do it for kind of for their own reasons. And in the years since then, I can't remember exactly where I picked up this quote, but the essence of leadership is achieving results through others. And the only way you can achieve results through others when you don't have that sort of boss card to play is to get them to want to do it, you know? And then kind of that turns out to be a much more effective way to get people to work on things, even if you are the boss. And so like that's a piece of strategy that I try to employ kind of all the time is like, you know, how can we talk about something and how can I talk with an individual about, you know, let's do this thing, you know, because it's because it's going to be good for you, because it's going to be good for us as a team. You know, that's just like, I can't sort of put enough value on that approach, because you can play the boss card, but you only have like two boss cards in your whole deck. and once you've played those, then people get pretty tired of it. So you need to use those sparingly.
So at that point, you know, you had this, you know, big mission to change everything. How long had you been leading software teams at that point?
Well, so that's sort of a funny story to get to that point. I had been in some sort of informal leadership roles for a few years prior in my career. The first time I had ever actually officially been in charge of a team would have been, I guess, about 2010, where I was the engineering manager for the team that focused on the user interface at DoubleTake Software, which is now Carbonite. That was the first time I had actually spent in an official sort of leadership capacity. And that was only maybe, you know, 2 years or so before the Angie's List project.
Oh, wow. So you were a new leader and had this big project. When you made that transition, was this something that you always knew you were going to do and you're asking your boss for, hey, can I get a shot? Or was this something you're kind of like thrust upon you? How did that happen? That first leadership role?
Yeah, it was one of those things where I've kind of been a little bit of a latent leader, where when I look back on kind of my life, like, you know, at school and things outside of school, and then professionally early in my career, like, I felt like I'd always kind of had it in me. It was always kind of like a function of the roles that I would just naturally play on teams. But I was very explicit, like, on the surface about like not wanting to do it. You know, I viewed myself, at least externally, as I'm going to be like a deep technical expert, and I'm going to be an architect and an engineer, and I don't want to be a manager, and I don't view myself as a leader. But then kind of when the Angie's List project emerged, like, I kind of realized that, well, I've actually have been doing this like on my own for a long time, and kind of informally and not really acknowledging it. And when this project started, it was sort of very explicitly said to the small group of us, hey, you guys need to lead this project. And so then that's kind of when I guess like put two and two together, maybe that I had been doing this kind of my whole life and my whole career, but I hadn't really acknowledged it. And now it was time to acknowledge it. And so then kind of once I officially acknowledged it, I guess, then that, you know, kind of set me on a much, much clearer path. And I found out, oh, there's actual, you know, there's actual craft to this kind of work. Like being a manager, you know, especially when you're early in your career, sort of feels like dirty work because like, oh, like I'm coding, I'm doing the real work, and management is kind of the man keeping me down, you know. But then, like, once you realize that there is an actual craft to being a leader and a manager, and that is a very important craft, like, then it kind of snapped together for me. I'm like, okay, this is the path I'm on.
So thinking about that, Roger, at that point, that's, you know, just changing your self-perception as someone that's a leader and there's a craft to it. What are some, what's something that you believe right now that you think that version of Roger would have disagreed with? Something you've learned about that craft?
I think the easy answer to what younger Roger would not have believed that older Roger believes is that it's actually really hard to do this job because usually when you're an individual contributor and you see your manager, usually what you're seeing is the nuts and bolts of it, you know, the approving vacation and, you know, having a one-on-one conversation. And yeah, and you might be aware of some of the other kinds of nuts and bolts, like, you know, budget and whatever. But like the hard parts of the job are those pieces of, you know, communicating with people, rallying them around a cause, making sure they're developing, making sure they're getting better, making sure they're happy, you know, sort of finding the right ways to improve the team, but not in a way that, you know, is, you know, heavy-handed or, you know, kind of cookie cutter, because even as you build experience in different kind of management leadership roles. You know, every company is different, every team is different, every person is different. So every time you start a new one of these roles, you're learning kind of from the beginning. And so, you know, that's hard work, and it's complicated work, and people are complicated. And so that's what I try to tell people when they get into a management role. And I've been kind of in a role of managing managers for a while. And so I've spent some time hiring and developing managers. And so, you know, usually the first thing I say to folks that are entering this role is this is a brand new job. Like, everything you did before is helpful, and like, don't forget all that stuff. But like, the job you're doing now is a completely different job. So think of it that way.
Have you worked with managers? So when I made that transition, one thing I struggled with was evaluating my day by how much code I wrote. So my measuring stick for a good day was wrong. Do you see that in the managers that kind of make that transition?
Yeah, I think there's definitely that's an easy kind of trap to fall into is you think, oh, I was really good as an engineer, and this is kind of like what I did, and now I'm a manager, and now I feel like I'm not working, and I feel like I'm getting nothing done because I'm not doing coding anymore, and I'm in meetings, or I'm reading documents, or I'm whatever, and it feels like nothing is getting done. And again, I think that's kind of dovetails to the fact that it's a different job, and you need to be comfortable in this new job as sort of judging your productivity or your success is like, is my team able to do those things that I used to do really well, you know? And if that means spending a good chunk of the day quietly coding, like a measurement that you might take for yourself as a manager is, okay, is my team able to do that? Like, I can't do it anymore, but like, maybe my team can, and that's a good day for me.
So switching gears to hiring a little bit, just to give us a feel for the scope of your hiring, roughly how much did you do last year, and how much do you plan in the upcoming year?
Yeah, I think we brought on about 5 or 6 engineers last year, and we're looking to bring on probably around 8 next year.
So that's a decent chunk of hiring, and your existing team was like 15, 10 when you started last year?
Yeah, when we started the year, we probably were at like 10 to 12. We're now at around like 16 full-time folks, and we have a handful of contractors that kind of help out. So yeah, we'll be kind of bumping up on 30 next year.
So 50% growth, and then close to 50% growth again, roughly. Could you walk us through your hiring process from the candidate's perspective?
Yeah, sure. So we will have our positions posted on our own career site, as well as a handful of other platforms. So they'll find the posting through one of those channels, or if they're referred, you know, we'll just direct them to where they can apply. They'll do an application with our platform, and they'll get into our system. And then the first thing that will happen is one of our internal HR folks in cooperation with engineering leadership will kind of take a look at their application, make sure that they seem like they are a legit applicant and we're interested in taking the next step with them. Kind of do our first level screening at that process just by reviewing the application. And then we will submit their information to Woven Teams, and Woven will send them an email to the candidate, and it will have a link to the assessment that we provide for their particular role. And then the candidate will complete that assessment, submit the results, and then they'll hear from us kind of every step along the way to remind them to complete the assessment, to inform them of what the next steps are. And then if internally we're happy moving forward to the next step, they'll receive a call from us, and we'll do a phone screen, which usually is more of an in-person call to kind of gauge their fit from a culture perspective and their kind of excitement about the role, and let them ask some questions of us, because that's really the first time that they've actually talked to someone from Springbuck. And then if the phone call then goes well, they will be invited on for an on-site interview. Usually we'll have a couple of interview slots within that same time block where they will interview with the hiring manager and some leadership, as well as some peers on the team. And then if that goes well, they will receive information about an offer.
At each of those steps, sounds like you've got the scenario assessment piece, then you got the phone screen, then you've got the onsite. So thinking about that phone screen phase, what are some things that you would like to see that you don't see in candidates, or that you see that you don't like that causes folks to get screened out at that first stage?
Well, we want to make sure that they are excited about the company and about the role. And we usually just gauge that from how does the conversation go and do we feel like they've prepared. If there are any areas of the assessment that we want to have a little more kind of discussion on, that might very lightly happen in the phone call. Wouldn't necessarily dig into more technical areas there, but if, for example, they maybe had sort of a soft score in some of the communication pieces of the assessment, then the phone screen helps give us some more data on how do they communicate in person? Do they seem like the kind of person that will be helpful to others on the team? Do they seem like the kind of person that would, you know, be willing to kind of step up and share knowledge or receive knowledge when needed? So those are kind of the ways that the phone screen augments the assessment.
Gotcha. So it sounds like if folks don't make it past the phone screen, it's kind of a values culture alignment, or like a didn't prepare, not showing interest alignment are your common reasons. Is that what I'm hearing?
Yeah. I think those would definitely be ways that we would screen someone out of the phone process, is if they sound like a jerk, or if they don't act like they actually want to work here.
Seems important.
Indeed.
And this is a little bit of a controversial question, but if you had to pick between kind of technical capabilities and like the catalytic skills, like the soft skills, how would you rank those when you're making decisions for candidates?
Yeah, it's a cliche, but I will always look for someone who shows a willingness to learn things and can communicate well and has a track record of getting things done. I will take that every day over someone with really strong, detailed technical knowledge, but maybe lacking in that first set of categories. I think to me, the demonstrating both through conversation and behavior, like that you're able to take in information and then process it and produce an answer that is intelligent and helpful, you know, that is the core of that's the core of just working with humans in general. And it's also the core of solving problems that we do, you know, in the software world. And so I think for folks that are smart and motivated and able to communicate and able to get help and work with others, there's no substitute. There's no technical skill that can substitute for any of that. So I will almost always prioritize someone that has those catalytic skills over technical skills.
So, and you have a process right now where you're not the only person doing phone screens, is that right?
Yes.
So how do you ensure the standardization of evidence about those catalytic skills across the phone screens?
Yeah, I think we could be better at that. Certainly when we complete this phone screen, whoever does it includes notes, and there's sort of a template set of questions that we like to ask to trigger some of the responses that we're looking for. And you know, we try to pass that on as they move along in the process. But I think that that's a piece of the hiring process in our world that is still pretty unstructured. So I think there's room to make it more consistent.
So kind of asking semi-standardized questions and then taking notes, and this is like in your ATS is where you typically do that?
Yes.
So thinking about the technical side. So you know, you try to standardize the questions to get the catalytic skill measurements. How do you ensure you're gathering the best evidence for the technical capabilities?
Yeah, we certainly lean on the assessment that Woven provides to give us some pointers as to what those skills look like and how they rank. As part of the process of building the assessments, you know, we work with Woven to calibrate the the exam with some of the folks we have internally that kind of helps us kind of know what the different levels of the assessment are. And then when it comes to the on-site interview portion, if we ask them, you know, any more technical questions, again, it's a little bit unstructured. It's still pretty much kind of up to the assessment of the interviewers, but we still have a relatively small team here. So, and a lot of the senior folks that we have involved are the same folks that are providing feedback on each candidate. So we kind of have a natural consistency there between the kind of people we involve in the interview.
Gotcha. So you get this assessment, and then you ask more technical questions on the on-site, and you have a lot of overlap with your interviewers, which gives you confidence that you're consistent there. What about cultural fit or cultural ad, or however you describe that? How do you kind of gather evidence for that?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. I kind of have a theory that the cultural component of pretty much any candidate is probably baked in within about 30 seconds of either meeting them in person or talking to them on the phone. I think it'd be pretty difficult to standardize a set of questions that kind of try to capture like what that means, because I think oftentimes it's kind of, you know it when you see it. And that's where I think I like how the conversation kind of goes in the industry of focusing on cultural ad as opposed to cultural fit, so that you get a set of, you know, diverse folks in your culture as opposed to kind of monoculture. But I think that's a very difficult thing for humans that are involved with evaluating people, because I think you naturally will make a very quick assessment of someone kind of based on that first impression, and that assessment will almost be unable to change no matter how long the interview goes.
So the blink theory of culture fit seems tough to get around. This show is brought to you by my startup, Woven. At Woven, we help software teams hit ambitious hiring goals. We do that by improving the fuzziest step in the hiring process, candidate screening. By giving every candidate a fair chance to show what they can do, our customers find more great candidates, and they back their decisions with evidence to remove bias. If you want to learn more about how Woven could help you scale your development team, check us out at woventeams.com. So this next section, we're going to switch to kind of a rapid fire mode. So we're going to got a bunch of questions, and these are from the perspective of someone who is thinking about applying to Springbok. So that kind of gives you like the target audience in mind. Ready to do it?
Ready.
Here we go. What's the biggest mistake you've ever made in an interview?
I think in general, I definitely I've entered some interviews not being prepared, not having done a little bit of homework on kind of who I'm speaking with, what the role actually entails, what the company kind of does as a business. And so you can tell very quickly, like, not every set of folks to interview people have expectations for that level of prep you've done, but if they have expectations and you haven't done that, again, I think you know pretty quickly that it's not going to work. And I've been on that side of the table before, where I don't know who you are. I don't really know exactly what this company does. And then it feels like a pretty bad interview from there on out.
Walk us through the interview that you've had that had the most lasting positive impact on your impression of a candidate.
Well, we interviewed a person here at Springbok for a pretty highly placed engineering position. And this candidate had a very strong resume, had very tightly, had a lot of experience that was very closely related to what we do. So we already had a really good feeling about bringing this person in. And then when we spoke to them in person, they just continued to impress ourselves with what they knew about the industry, what they knew about our business, what ideas they had, the kind of thing they've done. They were just sort of unintentionally brainstorming solutions to problems that we had already had here that they didn't even know were problems. And so we kind of, me and the other folks in the interview panel sort of made eye contact across the room of like, you know, can we just have this person start right now? And luckily that candidate ended up joining us and has continued to work out and continues to exceed expectations.
What does a 6-star culture edition look like? So even better than 5 stars.
Well, I would say they would exhibit some behavior kind of like I just described, where they not only can kind of read the room of what's here today and know how to fit into that and kind of be able to you know, pick up on the vibe of a place and become a good teammate, but then they also kind of have an instinctive feel for like what's the next step and what's the way to make this place even better and what do I bring to the table that maybe wasn't here before. And you know, they usually, the people that say those kind of words out loud in an interview are not the kind of people that you actually want to be able to do that, but the people that can sort of have a feel for like how can we improve the culture, how can we improve how we do things, and they just kind of bring that, and they just naturally start doing that without announcing that they're going to do that. Like, to me, that's the sweet spot.
More of those folks would be nice.
Indeed.
It's hard to find. What's an interesting problem your team will be working towards in the next year or so?
Well, we deal with a lot of data, and we deal with a lot of very sensitive data, and we deal with a lot of messy data. And the key value that, you know, the Springbug platform provides to our customers is this data that's messy and incomplete and sort of large in volume and very complicated. Like, it actually represents things that are really important to human beings, you know, the health of these individuals, and it represents things that are really important to the health of companies, since healthcare costs are constantly on the rise, and that's continually eating into the, you know, the bottom lines of companies. Like making sense of this messy, complicated data is just critical. So our platform is we're going to be building exactly that in this coming year. And you know, this is a problem that won't be solved in exactly 12 months. It'll go on forever. But we have a number of initiatives underway where we are going to make our data pipeline much more powerful, much more robust. We're going to make how that data is ingested into our platform, you know, much more performant. And then we're going to be able to take the data that's in the platform and present it and expose it to the people that need it in much more intuitive and interesting ways. So there's a lot of pieces to that. I think each one of those pieces is going to be a big challenge, and it's going to require a lot of innovative thinking and hard work. So I think we've got a little bit of something for everybody.
Just solving disease with data, no big deal.
Yes, indeed.
What advice do you have for an engineer looking to get hired on your team?
Yeah, I think show passion for the mission of the company, show passion for the kinds of problems we're going after, do the things that make the best impression of yourself, you know, prepare for the interview, do a little bit of research on the company, bring some work that you've done that shows what you can do. And that doesn't need to be, you know, within our particular industry or within our particular technology stack. But if you show up to an interview and you can sort of demonstrate that you're excited about Springbug as a company and you have a passion for building things and doing things that look good and work great, then you will have gotten the interview off to a very good start.
So be passionate, do your research, and show up with ideas. Thank you, Roger. I appreciate your time.
Yeah, thank you, Wes.
Thanks again to Roger for sitting down with me to talk about his journey. Here are my top takeaways from our conversation. Today, Roger is the textbook definition of a software leader, but he didn't always view himself that way. In fact, for years, he prided himself on not being a manager. He was a creator, a builder, not a manager. But as Roger's career progressed, he realized this narrative was both counterproductive and not accurate. It didn't represent who he was. Roger dreams of building great things. Things that one person couldn't build by themselves. By definition, if he was going to build those great things, he had to manage people. As he said, the definition of leadership is someone who gets results through others. And for him to achieve the results he wanted, he needed to lead a team. Furthermore, After reflecting on his life, Roger realized that whether he liked it or not, he was a leader. He naturally found his way into leadership roles over and over again, both on projects in and outside of work. He was a leader, he just didn't know it yet. Roger was, to borrow his words, a latent leader. Here are a few of the key lessons I picked up from Roger today. Lead by influence, not by mandate. As Roger said, you can play the boss card, but you only have two boss cards in your whole deck. This is a vital thing to remember for those of us in leadership roles. It's also important to reflect on times where you didn't think you played your boss card, but your direct report took an offhand comment as a directive. In these cases, you're still playing your boss card, and it's important to clearly communicate your intentions to avoid this confusion. Focus on cultural add, not cultural fit. This is a big one for me as I work to grow my team at Woven. We want to create an inclusive environment where all feel welcome, but if I try to find people who fit in with my co-founders and I, we'll never hire anyone different than us. Instead, we need to focus on finding people that complement us and add to our culture, making it richer. Four candidates. Prove you can work with people. If you're looking to make a career move, this is great advice. At the core of engineering is working with others. So proving that you can work with your teammates is as important as coding. As Roger told us, demonstrate that you're able to take in information, process it, and produce an answer that is intelligent and helpful. This is the core of working with people. I'm excited to learn along this journey with you, and I'm always looking for your feedback about how to make the show better. If you have anyone you think I should interview, tweet me at Wes Winham or at Woven_teams, and I'll reach out. Thank you so much for listening and subscribing, and I'll see you next Monday.